From NPR News, this is a special report on the healthcare debate in America. I'm Robert Siegel. In the coming week, members of Congress return to Washington from their summer recess, and healthcare will be at the top of the agenda for the senators and representatives, just where it was when they left Washington in early August. And President Obama plans to greet the returning lawmakers with an address to a joint session of Congress Wednesday evening, an address that is calculated to stimulate legislative action. Congress adjourned with things in a muddle. Both chambers failed to meet President Obama's ambitious timetable, one bill in each house before they left town. There was some progress. In the House, three committees approved revised versions of the original bill, H.R. 3200, America's Affordable Health Choices Act of 2009. The three bills have to be merged into one, with floor debate and a vote possible this fall. Over in the Senate, progress was glacial. The Gang of Six, three Democrats and three Republicans on the Finance Committee, met daily through much of July to craft a bipartisan compromise, and they left town without reaching an agreement. When lawmakers of both parties went home in August, many were greeted by angry opponents of the health care plans that were under consideration. Town hall meetings with constituents sometimes turned into shouting matches.
I have a question.
My question to you is, why do you continue to support a Nazi policy, as Obama has expressly supported this policy? Why are you supporting it?
One day God's going to stand before you, and he's going to judge you and the rest of your damn cronies up on the hill.
Kill the bill!
Thank you, Jim.
In many cases, the anger was orchestrated by groups determined to defeat the president, to deprive him of a victory on anything. Responses to the shouts varied. Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, the Republican recently turned Democrat, tried political bromide.
Okay. We've just had a demonstration of democracy. Okay.
Maryland Democratic Senator Benjamin Cardin tried reason.
This bill will be paid for. The president said it will be paid for primarily within the health care system itself.
And Massachusetts Democratic Representative Barney Frank tried confrontation.
On what planet do you spend most of your time? You want me to answer the question? Yes, as you stand there with a picture of the president, defaced to look like Hitler, and compare the effort to increase health care to the Nazis, my answer to you is, as I said before, it is a tribute to the First Amendment that this kind of vile, contemptible nonsense is so freely propagated.
But the criticism at the town meetings was heard back in Washington, especially criticism of a government-sponsored health insurance plan to compete with private insurers. On August 16th, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius went on the CNN program State of the Union and seemed to back off the so-called public option.
This piece of the puzzle has had enormous focus, and the president continues to believe that it's good to have consumer choice, let people choose an option in the new marketplace, and it's good to have competition for the private insurers who will inherit a lot of new customers, and without competition, costs could skyrocket. In a monopoly system, it's not a great way to hold down costs. So he continues to be very supportive of some options for consumers. What we don't know is exactly what the Senate Finance Committee is likely to come up with. They've been more focused on a co-op, not-for-profit co-op as a competitor as opposed to a straight government-run program. And I think what's important is choice and competition. And I'm convinced at the end of the day the plan will have both of those. But that is not the essential element.
The media buzzed over that. Was the administration now willing to drop the public option? President Obama weighed in a few days later on a radio talk show in Philadelphia.
One of the options we talked about was a public option, where there wouldn't be a profit motive involved, it would be non-for-profit, and that public option would give you affordable health insurance. Now, what we've said is we think that's a good idea, but we haven't said that that's the only aspect of health insurance. And what she essentially said was is that all these other insurance reforms are just as important as the public option. The press got a little excited, and some folks on the left got a little excited about this. Our position hasn't changed. We think that the key is cost control, competition, making sure that people have good quality options. If we're able to achieve that, that's the end that we're seeking.
The dog days of August and the First Family's summer vacation provided some punctuation to the health care debate. Media coverage then turned to the death of Senator Edward Kennedy, the Massachusetts Democrat who had called working for universal health care the cause of his life. His issue was suddenly broached with the polite bipartisan respect befitting eulogies and memorials, a tone that is not expected to last long as lawmakers return to Washington. Coming up later in this hour, we'll talk with NPR health and political reporters and editors about the next battles over health care. First, we want to take a look back at the reasons health care is at the top of the agenda in Washington and what causes so much emotion to swirl around the idea of overhauling the system. Earlier this year, I visited Howard County, Maryland, home to 275,000 residents, for a series called Healthy Howard, which aired originally on All Things Considered. We went to Howard County to hear from patients, doctors, administrators, and employers about the costs of health care and about access to the health care system. I asked them, what would define success in an overhaul of the healthcare system?
Clarity.
Offering affordable, comprehensive, quality health coverage for everyone who's
appropriate care for all Americans. That does not mean providing access to care through the emergency department for everyone.
Success would be working collaboratively with the government, with payers, with physicians.
We're not having to spend all of her Social Security check on one of her prescriptions is like $500 a month.
Having all kids be insured and that parents have adequate financial coverage for that access.
I think success would be everybody covered, but I think just kind of like auto insurance, you're going, you know, it's a pay or play.
That was small business owner Lynn Egan, Howard County Health Commissioner Dr. Peter Bielenson, Howard County General Hospital CEO Vic Broccolino, oncology practice administrator Linda Faggio, Lisa Martin, the daughter of an elderly patient, pediatrician Wendell McKay, and insurance broker Lisa Jawless. Howard County is not typical. It's prosperous, it's progressive, it's in Maryland, where the state government sets hospital fees. Howard County General Hospital is part of the elite Johns Hopkins system, and last year the county itself launched its own program for the uninsured. When we visited Howard County General in May, we met Herb Houston a few days after he'd had emergency heart surgery. He's 61. He was in a semi-private room. Until that week, he had seldom seen the inside of a hospital. Here we pick up from the original story.
First time was in 1956 for a tonsillectomy. The second time was in 1973 for injuries in an auto accident.
Herb worked as a computer programmer from the late 1960s until 2005.
I worked on everything from huge mainframe computers down to personal computers and quite a few things in between.
He says he always had health insurance, insurance that he very seldom claimed against. Then, in his late 50s, Herb was laid off. For 18 months, he was covered by Cobra. Then Cobra ran out, and he didn't have a job. Herb knew that he needed another health insurance policy.
I was beginning to search around for a replacement plan when the current economic crisis hit. And instead of taking on new expenses, I had to desperately trim back my already existing expenses. The luckiest item for me was that I actually paid off my mortgage in August of last year.
The unluckiest was what happened one Saturday night in May.
I was at home about 10 p.m. when I woke from an after-dinner nap with pretty acute chest pains.
Herb Houston knew it was a heart attack. He called 911, and by the time I met him 3 days later, he had received a cardiac catheterization. He was in good spirits, completely satisfied with his treatment, and trying not to think about the cost, which should easily exceed $50,000. You know, thinking about your situation with so few hospitalizations in your life.
Yes.
All those years you were contributing premiums.
Exactly.
Putting money in.
The various insurers for my employer got a real bargain from me because I hardly ever made claims.
But now, Herb is uninsured. He is neither old enough for Medicare nor poor enough for Medicaid.
And the thing is, this is going to be continuing. I've gone from someone who had very little interaction with the medical profession to the complete opposite.
And the cost of it all is on him.
I'm just going to do your vital signs. I know that Dr. Minford added some new last...
On the other hand, there is Judy Weeder, who was also treated at Howard County General. She is 62. She lives in Ellicott City, Maryland. She's divorced, the mother of one grown child.
And I was diagnosed with breast cancer in February 2009. And I pay no premium, none. I'm one of the, probably few fortunates that... That is one of the benefits of where I work.
Your employer?
My employer. I have no monthly co-payments for my health insurance. That was a marvelous plus with this job I have.
What is in my drugs that is changing taste? Do you know?
The chemotherapy. Will
oh, it's the chemo that's doing it.
Yes, and you may feel that...
It's a private sector job. She's an executive assistant with a search firm. I was with Judy Weeder at Maryland Oncology. She was getting her second chemotherapy treatment that day. She has already had a lumpectomy, and she expects radiation treatments after the chemo. The cost to you will be?
Probably zero. Other than my co-pays, it's $20. I'm starting to get those reports back from my health insurance, and I'm seeing the many, 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 many thousands of dollars being spent on me. And I've only had one treatment and two surgeries. I'm blessed. I know it.
Coming up, what we heard in Howard County, Maryland about employers, health benefits, and the recession. And we'll talk with NPR health and political reporters and editors about what to expect in the health care debate as members of Congress return to Washington in the coming week. I'm Robert Siegel, and you're listening to a special report on the debate over health care in America. From NPR News. From NPR News, this is a special report on healthcare in America. I'm Robert Siegel. As members of Congress return to Washington, healthcare is at the top of their agenda. It's also at the top of President Obama's agenda, coverage for the uninsured and controlling costs.
There's a cost that now causes a bankruptcy in America every 30 seconds. By the end of the year, it could cause 1.5 million Americans to lose their homes. In the last 8 years, premiums have grown four times faster than wages. And in each of these years, 1 million more Americans have lost their health insurance.
In this hour, we'll be talking with NPR editors and reporters who cover health policy, politics, and business. We're also listening to excerpts from the Healthy Howard series, which aired earlier this year on All Things Considered. In reporting for that series, I visited Howard County, Maryland, to learn about how the healthcare system works in one slice of America. We've already heard from two people there with serious illnesses, one who is uninsured and the other whose insurance is paid for entirely by her employer and covers just about everything. Most people in Howard County are somewhere in between. But because of the recession, a lot of people who have insurance are becoming underinsured. In this excerpt from the Healthy Howard series, we hear from Linda Faggio. She administers an oncology practice.
We're seeing many patients that are uninsured, but also increasing number of patients who are underinsured and are simply not able to carry the adequate coverage or afford the adequate coverage, and the burden of the cost of that is now their own.
Out of pocket, they're paying for their own chemotherapy.
Absolutely. And you know, they may have a $5,000 or $10,000 deductible, and that's the only way they can afford coverage at all. No one anticipates that they're going to be diagnosed with cancer. And it's not unusual to have a dose of chemotherapy be multiple, several thousand dollars a dose, up to even $10,000 a dose.
Often, those patients have reduced their coverage because their employers have reduced their contributions. Lisa Jollis is a Howard County insurance broker. Her clients, the employers, have typically experienced huge losses of business in the recession.
A lot of them, their thinking is the employee may have to pay more for the health plan, but they still have a job.
In hard times, save the jobs, trim the benefits.
That's what I'm seeing. I mean, I'm seeing employers who had paid 100% of everything cutting back to we're paying 25% of everything, but you still have a job.
Well, before we start, let's just check a couple of...
One of her clients is Lynn Egan, who employs 15 people at Lakeview Title in Columbia, Maryland. They do mortgage closings.
Property address is correct.
There's been a rare bright spot to the business lately. Homeowners are refinancing en masse, so there are closings once again.
Interest rate, 4.75%.
But when the residential real estate market crashed, Lynn Egan cut her staff, and she went from paying 100% of her employees' health insurance to a 50-50 split. There are also higher deductibles that are covered in part by health savings accounts.
Of course, 2008, we didn't know what hit us. So, of course, we needed to make adjustments for the economy. Every business did. Obviously, we needed to look at cuts in the payroll. In our whole budget, health care was a big number.
How big? For a family of four, how much does health insurance cost?
Oh, I would guess probably about $1,100 a month.
$1,100 a month, or $13,000 a year,
right,
something
right.
on that order.
Yeah.
What you used to do was cover that 100%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
50% would be $6,500 that you pay for, $6,500 that the employee pays
for
her family. So mm-hmm. Multiplied by 15 people adds up.
Right, and actually when we were doing that, we had probably 25 people, so it really added up.
We're talking about a couple $100,000.
That's
the difference here between which way you go.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and that's certainly a number that becomes unsustainable, especially when the economy starts to contract.
That was small business owner Lynn Egan in an excerpt from the series Healthy Howard, which aired on All Things Considered earlier this year. I'm joined now by NPR editor Joe Neal. Joe heads our health coverage, NPR health correspondent Julie Rovner, national political correspondent Mara Liasson, and David Kestenbaum of NPR's Planet Money reporting team. We'll come back to more on the politics in a few minutes, but David, let's start with a look at the economy and health care. In Howard County, when we went to talk about health care, we heard a great deal about the economy. That was a bit earlier in the summer. Same forces at play now as existed earlier in the summer?
Unfortunately, the economy last time we checked is still shrinking. The unemployment rate is 9.4%, but one of the few things not shrinking is the cost of health care. But look, let's not get distracted by this little recession here.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the rising cost of health care. I'll use the Obama Council of Economic Advisor numbers here, but they're not controversial. In 15 years' time, health insurance for a family will cost $25,000. That's roughly double what
Lynn Egan was talking about, yeah. That's right. Those prices rise way ahead of the rate of inflation, generally.
Right. And faster than the economy is growing.
Now, as for who is uninsured, Julie Rovner, who are the uninsured?
Well, there are about 45 million uninsured, according to the Census Bureau's. Later this month, we'll get the new numbers. Those will be from 2008. That's one in every six Americans. So it is an awful lot of people. About two-thirds of those people are poor or near poor, meaning they earn less than twice the poverty level. That's about $37,000 for a family of three. They're really not that wealthy. Only 10% of them had income over four times poverty. Adults are more likely than children to be uninsured because they're less likely to be eligible for government health programs. And yes, young people just starting out do tend to lack insurance, but more than half of the uninsured in 2007 were actually over the age of 30. Fewer than a third were between the ages of 19 and 29. So just taking care of those, you know, young people who think that they won't, you know, they're invulnerable is not really going to solve this problem.
Obviously, underinsured is a much more subjective a description than uninsured. Who are the underinsured?
Well, generally, experts describe the underinsured as people at risk of spending either 5% or 10% of their annual income on out-of-pocket medical costs, depending on their income. There are, by many estimates, about 25 million people who are underinsured. And what's most frightening is that most of those people don't know it. You generally don't know you're underinsured until you get very sick and discover that your insurance doesn't cover what you need. And it is a frighteningly large number if you then add it to the number of people who are uninsured.
And yet, the majority of people still would, by these designations, be just considered neither uninsured nor underinsured, but insured.
Yes, but it's a majority, but it's not a large majority. If you add those two numbers together, the 45 million who are uninsured and the 25 million who are underinsured, it's getting to be a large number.
Well, Mara Liasson, from a political perspective, how do these questions play with the public? What do we know about where the public stands on health care reform?
Well, where the public stands on healthcare reform has really changed. I think as long as the debate was on the level of broad, sometimes vague principles, the public was very supportive of the idea, the big abstract idea of healthcare reform. They like the idea of everyone being covered. They don't mind an individual mandate. They certainly want costs to be under control, as the president has promised. They want the bills to be deficit neutral. They want their own coverage to be stable and portable and cost less if possible. And they like some of the reforms like a ban on refusing to provide insurance for someone who has a pre-existing condition. What's happened to the public support is that as more details have come out about specific bills that have been discussed in Congress, public support for this has gone down. And in our latest poll that is done by a Democratic pollster, Stan Greenberg, and a Republican, Glenn Bolger, we found more people opposing what they call the Obama health care plan mm-hmm. than supporting it. Now, there is no actual specific Obama health care plan. There's just this House plan that's been kind of stuck to him like glue because of the legislative strategy that he's chosen. So right now, there's a lot of skepticism. The support among independents, which is probably the most important group that we look at, has dropped the most. And right now, the public is wary and fearful that this is going to cost them a lot of money.
Mara, Julie Rovner, David Kestenbaum, and also Joe Neal, we're going to resume this conversation in a moment. First, we're going back, though, to Howard County, Maryland, and we're going to hear now from some health care providers. I went to Howard County General Hospital to meet Vic Broccolino, the hospital CEO, in the emergency room there, and that's where he talked about a big issue in health care cost and how all that money is spent.
The standard is 40% of the people in the emergency department don't need to be there, but for the fact they don't have anywhere else to go. And Americans, with their obsession for instant gratification, have to go somewhere to receive care. They cannot wait until the next day to see a primary care physician, which would accommodate most of their needs, frankly, if they were willing to wait.
One way to cut costs, he says, would be to get more people to see primary care physicians. President Obama has won commitments from hospital groups and insurers to cut the rate of increase of their costs by 1.5 percentage points a year over the next decade. So what have cost increases been at Vic Broccolino's hospital?
It depends on how you want to measure costs. If you want to measure costs as how much has our budget increased from year to year, I don't think that's a good measure because we've been seeing more and more patients. If you look at equivalent inpatient admissions, which is a measure where we take the numbers of actual inpatient admissions, take the number of outpatient services we provide, and try to equate that into an inpatient admission, our costs have gone anywhere from 4 to 10%, depending on the year.
Could you easily figure how you get that down to 3.5%?
I mean,
do you look around the hospital and see it?
No, I couldn't easily do that without trying to modify the behavior of some of the patients and some of the physicians, and working with them to modify that behavior through, again, more primary care, providing more primary care in the community, perhaps getting the government, local and state, to participate with us and provide some services at that level.
I also heard about the cost of health care from pediatrician Wendell McKay. Dr. McKay is in a group practice. It's a business. And to save money and help provide better care, Dr. McKay wants electronic record keeping.
I think it's senseless that we have someone who can go to a hospital and have to rely on phone call after phone call to get information from the primary care doctor. That information should be centralized, should be accessible, using the technology that we have.
Walking through your practice here, it's unmistakable. There are perhaps thousands of file folders, alphabetized, color-coded.
I would say 10,000.
10,000
yes.
They could occupy all of, a couple of flash cards, yes. A couple of chips if you had electronic record keeping.
Yes.
Why? Why aren't you already electronic?
We are on our way, but the biggest reason is because of cost. It costs us too much money, or it has in the past, to use the technology that's currently available in the marketplace. And if there is financial assistance in the form of either incentives to do that, incentives to the marketplace to reduce costs for physicians, and rewards to the physicians who use that technology to become more efficient and document and demonstrate that, I think all that would help.
But here's a problem that I heard about from hospital CEO Vic Broccolino. He says his 700-plus staff physicians represent some 300 to 350 practices. Many, he told me, have electronic information systems, but
I would say there are probably no more than 10 practices that have one particular information system. We have another information system at the hospital. So we have to attempt to interface our system with theirs. And it's impossible.
Let's turn now to NPR health editor Joe Neal. Joe, electronic record keeping. I've heard what the problems are. Is it a conceivably a very large savings in costs to actually achieve it?
Well, I think the jury is still out on whether there will be a savings. It obviously costs a lot to invest in these systems. One of the main problems is that there is no one standard for computers, so there will be additional costs as we go down the road with 7, 8, 10 different computer systems. The Obama administration put $19 billion of stimulus money out there for doctors and hospitals to install these systems on the thesis that it would save money, but I don't think that's clear that it will.
So cost is one obstacle to whatever might be achieved through it. Other problems?
Privacy is a big issue. Patients are reluctant to have their information computerized. Doctors are also concerned about some privacy issues. But perhaps the biggest obstacle is doctor resistance to adopting computer systems. Right now, very few doctors have adopted it, and actually very few hospitals have complete electronic health record systems where they can exchange information at will.
And are we remarkably different from other countries in this regard? How do they do it?
Not really. Most countries are at about where we are. The UK is more advanced. They, of course, have a centralized system, a socialized system. And it's easier for them to adopt new systems because they pay everyone, they own everything, and they can just implement it. Here with a private system, we have many different standards, many different computer systems.
Of course, what Dr. McKay said about electronic record keeping and what Vic Broccolino said about more primary care was, we can save money, but first we have to spend more money.
That's right.
Here's what I heard from another doctor in Howard County, Maryland, Dr. Mark Appelstein, who echoed Dr. McKay on the inefficiencies in the system. Appelstein is a urologist. He's a specialist, so he orders tests, many tests, to properly diagnose his patients and to protect himself. The result, according to Dr. Appelstein, is inordinate waste.
There is hours spent on paperwork, approval, hiring staff people, constantly verifying insurances, getting approval for procedures, whether it be surgical procedures or if I order an x-ray, a CAT scan or MRI on a patient, there are certain insurers that we have to call and get approval and go through these various phone trees. And at times they deny them, so then I have to get on the phone and call the medical director. And in 20 years, I've never been denied a surgical procedure on a patient or ordering a test on a patient. But yet we continue to have to ask for permission and mother may I, and I just don't get it.
But explain this, what strikes me as a contradiction here, which is we spend too much on health care. We employ a lot of people who work between the insurance industry and physicians. But ultimately you get the tests okay. You go ahead and you do the procedures that you ask for. In a really cost-controlled system, wouldn't somebody be saying no? Somebody saying, this country orders too many tests, you can't do it?
Well, we do order too many tests. And the concern by physicians of, if I don't order this test and I miss something, I will be sued. And that is a real problem.
You're practicing defensive medicine in part when you order
yes,
that test.
Yes, and it's, you know, physicians, for the most part, I think try and do their best. But physicians are people, and they make mistakes. And if there is some egregious error, clearly someone should be compensated that on some level. But, you know, personally, I do order tests at times for fear that, well, if I don't get this and I miss something, then I have no defense.
Julie Rovner, defensive medicine, a costly problem of the American healthcare system?
Well, certainly a lot of people think so. Certainly a lot of doctors think so. People have tried to study this. Of course, to study it, you really have to crawl inside a doctor's head. Basically, what we know about defensive medicine is that some of these tests are needed for these patients. Some of these tests are good for these patients. Some of these tests are probably not needed for these patients. And some of these tests simply line doctors' pockets. What we don't really know is how many do what. What we also know is that doctors tend to practice the way other doctors around them practice. We call it community standards. In places where, you know, there's places where doctors do a lot of tests, and there's other parts of the country where doctors don't do as many tests. And what researchers have discovered is that patient outcomes tend to not necessarily be better where doctors do a lot of things to do more things to more patients.
And this leads to the larger question of what is the influence of malpractice on the entire subject? And you would say not that much, 1 to 2% or so.
That's right. That what we do know about malpractice is that when you look at the actual impact on healthcare cost, it's really relatively small. It's a big issue in terms of rhetoric. It's a small issue in terms of cost.
Thank you, Julie Rovner, also Joe Neal, and David Kestenbaum and Mara Liasson. There's more to come. We'll hear from all of you, and we'll hear another excerpt from the Healthy Howard series from All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and you're listening to a special report on healthcare in America from NPR News. From NPR News, this is a special report on healthcare in America. I'm Robert Siegel. The problems and challenges of the healthcare system are relatively easy to define, certainly easier than defining solutions or alternatives to the current system. In a few minutes, we'll hear from NPR health, business, and political reporters and editors about the alternatives that are being debated on Capitol Hill. First, though, we'll look at a local system developed in Howard County, Maryland, where I visited earlier this year for the All Things Considered series Healthy Howard. Howard County figured that it had 20,000 people who lived there legally, that's not including illegal immigrants, 20,000 people who had no health insurance. So last year, the county launched a program to provide the uninsured with access to health care. It's called the Healthy Howard Access Plan. It's still very new, but it offers some lessons that could be applied nationwide. The Howard County Health Commissioner, the man in charge of Healthy Howard, is Dr. Peter Bielenson. And in this excerpt from the original report, Dr. Bielenson described the program.
Our Healthy Howard plan, for a very, very modest fee of $50 to $80 per person per month, so between $600 and $900 per person per year, you get the following. You get 6 or 7 visits, depending if you're a man or a woman, to our primary care center. You get the hospital and emergency room costs waived. You have pro bono specialty services in about 17 different specialties, including mental health and substance abuse parity in and outpatient, and dental is included as well. We have prescription medication subsidies for those that we're not able to get for people for free. We are leveraging existing pharmacy assistance programs that Big Pharma has out there that almost no one who's uninsured knows about. And very importantly, every single person in our plan gets a personal health coach who doesn't call them, but rather meets with them face-to-face and develops a health action plan.
Health Commissioner Bielenson is both proud of the Healthy Howard program and also mindful of the cautionary lessons that he's learned in its first few months. Lesson number one, the ranks of the uninsured include lots of people who are actually entitled to existing public coverage. Of those 20,000 uninsured in Howard County, 5,000 were children, and about 25% of them were enrolled in short order in the existing Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. Of the 15,000 adults under 65, about one-third of them also turned out to be eligible for some existing state or federal health plan, even though they either didn't know that or hadn't bothered to enroll. Dr. Bielenson said that confirms what people think about the uninsured nationally.
And all the studies that we've seen nationally show that between 25 and 30% of the uninsured in the country are eligible for existing entitlement programs and either don't know it or don't sign up. That is an important lesson to be learned because of the 48 to 50 million uninsured Americans, you could say, even to be conservative about it, 10, 12, 14 million of them you don't have to have any new program whatsoever. You just have to do better outreach and better targeting of people to get them enrolled in those programs.
But words like outreach and targeting turn out to be much easier said than done, which brings us to the next lesson. Of the 10,000 uninsured adults who are eligible for Healthy Howard, people whose incomes are no more than three times the poverty level, how many have signed up for the program that was designed specifically for them?
200 are in the program, fully enrolled, and about 390 more are in the queue. They have screened eligible and are in the process of providing documentation to get enrolled.
That is not quite 600 people, less than 6% of the 10,000 who are eligible, and it's been 7 months. Dr. Bielenson admits that if the program had been deluged with thousands of applicants from day one, it would have been overwhelmed. But if health coverage is the huge concern that we think it is, and Healthy Howard is about as cheap as you can get it, why so few people?
Clearly there are some, the young invincibles, the 22 to 25 to 35-year-olds, 40-year-olds, who
they're
going to
live forever.
They're going to live forever. The costs are somewhat problematic, even though it's very reasonable at $50 to $85 per person per month, far less than insurance. It nonetheless is something, and for a lot of people who are having trouble holding jobs during this recession or have lost their jobs, economics play some part of it.
That's Health Commissioner Peter Bielenson of Howard County, Maryland. And I'm now joined in our studio by Julie Rovner, David Kestenbaum, Joe Neal, Mara Liasson, people who cover and edit this entire subject for NPR's various programs. And let's start with the big cost here. How much will a health care overhaul cost the federal government? Julie?
Well, this is interesting. It's kind of a two-part question. When you first bring people into the system, it will definitely cost more. So the estimates are that over the first 10 years of any program, it'll cost about $1 trillion over those 10 years. And it's been in paying for that this program has really sort of stumbled in the public's eye. Over the longer term, it's at least hoped that some of the changes that could be made would start to save money. The problem is the Congressional Budget Office that is charged with scoring or deciding how much things cost doesn't do cost estimates beyond 10 years. So they won't be able to say whether or not some of these changes that people are anticipating will save money. And besides, a lot of the changes that are being talked about have never been tried before. So when the Congressional Budget Office would look at them, they would have no previous evidence to suggest that they would or wouldn't save money. So even if they could, they wouldn't be able to say. So it's been a really big issue about how much this would cost.
I'd like to hear from you folks about, I guess, one of the most controversial questions that arose about healthcare overhaul, and that is rationing. If indeed the curve is to be bent on healthcare spending, that is, the rate of increase is to be reduced, presumably somebody's getting less healthcare, or at least the providers are getting less money for it. Does that mean that there will be rationing, there will be death panels deciding when people have had enough medical care? Joe Neal.
Well, obviously, opponents have made quite a bit out of Sarah Palin's introduction of death panels into the discussion. But it's important to note that rationing already exists. The 46 million uninsured are not able to access health care easily. Many of them do get health care in emergency situations, but they do not have full coverage. And I think all of us have had the experience of having an insurance company turn down a claim. Mm-hmm. That's certainly a form of rationing. You know, it's sort of a decision whether we want a corporate bureaucrat to be making these decisions or whether we want to have an open public process.
Well, earlier in the program, we heard Dr. Appelstein, the urologist, say when he orders tests, he'll get grief from the insurance company trying to justify. They'll always approve it in the end, he said. Should we expect after a new system is in place that some tests will be turned down and that we as patients may receive fewer tests than we do today?
It's not clear whether it would be any different than it is now. And I think there's another point to be made here is that insurance companies take a lot of the heat for denying coverage. In fact, it's employers who decide what kind of benefits people get in their plans. You can have a very luxurious plan that covers everything. You can have a more moderate plan. And that, in and of itself, is also rationing.
Mara, run down the politics here. What we know about what people think of issues like these.
Well, the politics of this are quite dicey at this moment. August was a month when the president's health care reform effort took on a lot of water. Some people say it hangs by a thread. There's a lot of unsolicited advice that's being aimed at the White House right now about what President Obama needs to do to get control of the debate again. His popularity numbers have gone down quite quickly as his health care plan has
taken all this criticism. I think that health care is absolutely critical to the president. I think this is something he has to have. And I think all along the White House was prepared to take almost anything that they could say was health reform that met their broad principles. But the big question now is, when the president comes back to work, what is he going to do differently? Is he going to continue this kind of endless round of town hall meetings and interviews talking about his principles? Or is he going to, as many big players are suggesting to him, lay out more specific pieces of a health care bill that he would be for? One of the biggest problems for the president's volunteer army that was supposed to rise up and help him pass his agenda is that they don't know what they're advocating. The opponents certainly know what they're against. You know, and that is the big question. Will the president get weighed more into the specifics? I don't think that the Democrats can afford to go into next year's midterm elections without a bill. There are people like James Carville, the Democratic strategist, who say, oh, let it fail and then blame it on the Republicans. I think that they're going to have to pass something. And I think what's interesting about this debate, unlike in 1992 when Bill Clinton tried and failed to pass health care reform, is Democrats know this. They know that they absolutely have to pass something. They can't let an internal party debate kill this.
Julie Robner, we've heard about public opinion. Opinion on Capitol Hill?
Well, of course, I think Congress is going to come back a bit spooked about what happened during August and some of those town meetings. You know, what we didn't really see very much in the media were an awful lot of town hall meetings that were very civil and a lot of, you know, very rational discussion about these things. But, of course, that didn't make for, you know, great TV. There weren't people yelling at each other. But the fact is, Congress comes back. The House has not voted on this yet. The House would like to take a vote on it sometime in September. The Senate, of course, we're waiting for this gang of six, these six pivotal members of the Finance Committee. They have set now a new deadline of September 15th to get an agreement, but we don't know how firm that deadline is going to be yet. The three Republicans who are in the room, at least two of them, Finance Ranking Member Chuck Grassley and Mike Enzi from Wyoming, have basically both said during the month of August that they're not very excited about anything that's been talked about. So it's hard to know what kind of bill they might be willing to agree to. So things, you know, if Congress left with things in a bit of a muddle, they certainly come back with things in a bit of a muddle. And yes, they, you know, perhaps they will have to go to this, you know, what they call the nuclear option of budget reconciliation, where they only need, you know, a bare majority, 51 votes in the Senate. But that would be a purely Democratic bill, and that might lead to problems of its own and charges of, you know, trying to ram something through. So it's all very precarious as Congress returns to session.
You know, there is one other thing that I think happened in August. Yes, it got muddled and confusing, but I do think that the debate moved to the right. You might say it moved to the center, but that is the direction that this is now going. The public option has been shown to have not enough support to pass through Congress, at least a robust public option. And now we're left talking about something that Olympia Snowe, who is probably the key Republican, the one that seems
Republican
to be
Senator from Maine. Maine,
who seems to be negotiating in the best faith of any of the Republicans. She likes a public option that would be triggered only when needed, kind of like the trigger in the Medicare Part D, the prescription drug coverage plan George W. Bush passed.
If the rate of uninsured should reach a certain
something
level.
Something like that. There would be some
public insurance
criteria laid out. And
it,
yes. And so we're talking about that. But I do think that what everybody's been wondering, what kind of package could pass through Congress with either the bare number of Republicans that the White House could use to say it is actually bipartisan. And I think that the notion of what that package is has begun to look more and more centrist as the month has gone on.
Joe Neal.
And I would just point out that we're likely in the next month, on September 10th, we're expecting these new numbers out from the Census Bureau, which will show that the number of uninsured in 2008 went up significantly. We'll probably be starting to talk about 50 million uninsured, perhaps even more. So I think that there could be a shift back even more toward the center of the left.
But that's not what's driving this debate. The uninsured has never been the White House target. People with health insurance have always been the White House target because they are the bigger group, and they're the ones that President Obama has tried to reassure over and over again. This is not some kind of a moral fight to cover the uninsured. As wonderful a goal as that might be, that has never been the primary political goal of the White House.
Isn't part of the problem here, President Obama tells people, if you have health insurance and you like it, nothing will change.
So
a majority of Americans, if only a bare majority, though, are wondering, if nothing's going to change, why should I risk any kind of bill at all?
And the problem is that people don't believe him because, you know what? of course something has to change. People understand that you can't cover everyone and bring costs down and get all of the health care that you want.
Is it that Is it that they don't believe the president, or that they don't think collectively in terms of what's best for the entire economy when it comes down to them? Say, look, I'm okay. David Kestenbaum?
I think one of the things that's missing from this discussion is that it's really all about expanding coverage. There's very little in these proposals about doing the other part of what people want to do, which is driving down the cost. And I think people don't see how that comes out of this. This is really about, do we want to cover everybody or not? I think that's what's on the table now.
And people don't want to enough. That's the problem. People want their own coverage to cost less. And in a perfect world, maybe in a better economy, then they'd be willing to pay a little more to cover everyone.
Julie Robin.
I think the problem with health with this is that what it's always been. People want their costs to go down, and they want someone else to pay for it. And the problem is, if costs are going to have to go down, everyone's going to have to pay for it. And nobody ever wants to give anything up.
Well, I have a question for David Kestenbaum. I mean, this whole notion that how you control costs. The White House seems to say that we don't know yet. It's going to take us a number of years, 4 or 5 years, to figure it out, how these comparative effectiveness studies work, how to get the best practices replicated across the country, and that we can't expect costs to go down till after the 10-year window that the CBO uses to evaluate this. Are there things that could be in this bill right now that would control costs soon that wouldn't be draconian?
Define draconian. I mean, there are people who point out, I mean, one of the things, if you ask the Obama economic advisors, look, how much is there to save in the system? If we really squeezed, how much could we, without hurting anybody, how much could we, what's the waste? And the answer is, if you look at maybe 20-30%. If you look at
two or $300 billion, that's what they say.
Yeah, I mean that's substantial. You know, if you have a system that's wasting,
but it costs
30%.
A trillion.
Right. So there are places in America. You know, the Mayo Clinic is often cited, that actually managed to keep costs down while keeping people healthy and providing quality care. So the question is, you know, could you duplicate that in some way, or could you change the incentives? And there are lots of ideas out there, and none of them are really up for discussion.
Joe Neal?
But I can tell you, I had dinner with a group of doctors the other night, and they think it's ridiculous that you could get that much waste out of the system. They don't do anything that's wasteful. Now, there is a certain amount of criminality out there, and I do think that there's some that could be eliminated and captured, and you could get some money back. But I think the medical profession, at least, is very dubious.
But if we spend our health care dollars on doctors, hospitals, drug companies, and insurance companies, and if we're to reduce costs, then those groups will make less money. Clearly, nobody's stepping up and saying, I volunteer.
Right.
I volunteer.
Well, actually,
they have stepped
up in their own, you know, a big dramatic way to say, okay, I'll give you a quarter or a dime. I'll be willing to give up that.
You mean I'll reduce the increase in my
expenses?
Yes.
Well, look, Big Pharma, they cut a deal for themselves.
A year for 10 years.
Yeah, Big Pharma cut a deal for itself. The health insurance industry has said, we'll take certain hits, like having to cover people with pre-existing conditions. And
as did the hospitals.
Yeah, as did the hospitals. People have done that. But the question I also have is, what if the most effective, efficient care is the most expensive?
Right. Well, I often think about this. What if we come up with a magical drug or a machine that could keep anybody alive for an extra year and it's $1 million? At some point, we just can't afford that for everybody. So, you know, part of this discussion is just, it's just a fact of life that modern economies spend a lot of money on healthcare. There's stuff we could wring out of the system, waste we could get rid of. But this is a growing thing that we as an advanced economy have decided people are choosing to spend money on.
Oh, but I think before we go too far,
yes,
I think there have been a number of studies that have shown there are places in the country, it's not just the Mayo Clinic, there are areas of the country that spend less and that get better outcomes than other parts of the country. A lot of it's about incentives. The problem is it's difficult to change human behavior. By human behavior, I mean the patients and the doctors and the hospitals. Every penny that we spend on healthcare is someone's income. That's a big ship that's going to take a long time to turn around.
Joe Neal.
And if you look at the countries of Europe, we did a big series last year and looked at all of them. They have higher life expectancies. Our life expectancy here is going up, but it is still at the bottom of a group of 19 countries. They spend far less, do care much more efficiently. Many of their systems are very similar to ours, not with as much profit motive in some of them that takes a lot of money out of the system in this country, but they've been able to achieve the same kind of medical quality and outcomes that we do, and even better in many cases.
Do they have private insurers?
In Switzerland, certainly, in Germany, certainly.
And they're regulated like utilities.
Regulated very tightly with much lower profit margins.
Well, Julie Rovner, Mara Elias, and David Kestenbaum, Joe Neal, thanks to all of you for taking part in this discussion.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And all of you can visit npr.org for more of NPR's healthcare coverage. Our special report was produced by Giselle Grayson and edited by Beth Donovan, Joe Neal, and Stu Seidel. The audio engineers were Drew Reynolds and Ivan Burketh. Very special thanks to Julia Redpath Buckley and the staff of All Things Considered for all their work on the series Healthy Howard. I'm Robert Siegel, and this has been a special report on the healthcare debate in America from NPR News.